Well, I'm grateful to have an opportunity to talk about multiple phases of podzolization on the coastal plain of the southeastern United States. I want to express appreciation to my co-authors, Alan Bacon, Yaslin Gonzalez, Todd Osborne, and Rex Ellis. I want to acknowledge the personnel from Florida Soil Survey with NRCS and University of Florida who generated the data and through their efforts prompted research and ideas that have influenced this talk. And I want to express appreciation to the collaborators that are referenced on the slides, Florida soil scientists who shared soil photographs and some funding from the USDA, NRCS, and McIntyre Stennis. I'm going to begin with podzolization, and I say in the simplest terms, addressing a little bit of attention to theories that current theories, relevance of hydrology, and relevance of grain coatings in the podzolization process in this area. But I want to focus mainly on the faces themselves and implications of those faces. I call normal faces, contorted faces, faces at hydrologic transitions, faces of old dunes, drowned faces, and giant faces. And I want to finish up with some logical aspects of horizon designation that I think are important to address. My concept of podzolization is that it entails pedogenic transformation and joint accumulation of carbon and metals, and our part of the world here, it generally produces VH horizons that will qualify as spodic diagnostic horizons in the USDA system. And it obviously involves eluviation and illuviation profoundly. There are a couple of theories I mentioned here, the chelate complex theory, which invokes mobilization, translocation, and immobilization of organic metal complexes. Another idea or theory is the proto-amogolite theory, proposes separate transport of organic and inorganic phases. And I think that both of these theories probably are valid, but their applicability probably is dependent upon the local geographic conditions, parent material, vegetation in particular. I believe that in this area, the chelate complex theory best explains podzolization, but even it does not address hydrology to the extent that it needs to be addressed. So when we look at the distribution of podzolization worldwide, we find that the bulk of it is in upper northern latitudes, where you commonly have well-drained photosols, well-drained soils with drainage that is not restricted in any way to any hydrologic condition in particular, but commonly well-drained. And we have a hotbed down here where we are now, mainly restricted to imperfectly drained sites. That translates in the United States to a real geographic break in spodosol suborders. And with respect to north and south, we find that in the south we have primarily aquas, and in the north we have mainly orthides, triads, and humides. The distinction between non-podzolized and podzolized soils in this area relates to or is manifested through the presence or absence of sand grain coatings. In well-drained or well-to-excessively drained sand hills, we generally have the coatings that are relatively evenly distributed throughout the profile, but in poorly drained Flatwoods systems, we have kind of a two-tiered motif of stripped and coated sands as a result of podzolization. So here we have the coated sands and the clean sands, and so we have the two-tier on the, for the podzols and for the sandhill areas. We don't have that. We don't have the difference in distribution. So sand grains constitute a linkage between the hydrology, specifically fluctuating water table, and the podzolization process. So it behooves us to understand a little bit about what they are. And I've listed a few of my ideas based on my experience. They are about 2 to 8% of the soil by mass. They have similar proportions of silt and clay. The silt is mostly quartz. The clay itself is often mostly quartz. That seems weird for other places in the world, but not for Florida. But the clay can have quartz, phyllosilicates like kaolinite and hydroxymolybdenum vermiculite. It can have gibbsite. It can have oxides of aluminum, other oxides of iron and aluminum. And if they're not what people often think, they're not predominantly iron oxide coatings. Although iron and aluminum oxides do serve as a cement for the coatings. So if you want to destabilize the coatings, if you want to get enough clay off the sand to analyze by X-ray, then we have to work hard to get it off. One way to do it is to dissolve the iron and aluminum by using citrate, dithionate, bicarbonate, or something like that. So that's an important clue here as far as it's the effect of podzolization on sand grain coatings. And I'm going to carry that forth into my exposition of faces and the implications. These are what I call normal faces of, and just a few examples. What you see is a variety of boundary topography thickness. So you can have smooth, abrupt boundaries. You can have wavy, abrupt boundaries. You can have smooth, gradual boundaries and wavy, gradual boundaries of the upper contact between the E and the BH. The lower boundary of the BH generally fades gradually into the subjacent horizon, and that's a common trend, whereas despite the common abruptness of the upper boundary. The other aspect is that the thickness of the E, or the depth of the BH, can vary a lot, and I'm going to address that a little further later in the talk. When we look at soils with argillics, basically the podzolization process can be imprinted over a sandy, loamy motif. And if we didn't have that imprinting, we would basically have arenic and gross arenic paleozoals. So we can see that these two processes are sort of independent of each other. That is, the alluvial process is involved in ultrasol formation versus the alluvial processes involved in BH horizon development. These are the contorted faces. That means we can have highly irregular boundaries between the E and the BH horizon. Notice that it doesn't matter the direction of the boundary, the orientation of the boundary. It can be up, down, sideways. You generally always have the same gradation from at that boundary from the E to the BH. So what that means is that these are a consequence of a pedogenic flux of components from the E boundary into the BH boundary, into the BH. And so that means that they're not infillings. People sometimes think, look at this, it's like an infill zone, but actually that is a process that took place simultaneously in its development. You can infer from these images. I guess I have an explanation for this, but it's only hypothetical, that the water flow in these sands is influenced by a legacy of past vegetation, past bioturbation. So that's going to be like a photograph. Once this process will develop in a way that is influenced by water flow subsequent to those effects. So what happens at the hydrologic transition between flatwoods and drier soils? Well, this happens. We have as we move to the drier soil, obviously the relative water table depth. Remember, these are fluctuating water tables, so I have to qualify that this is a relative depth. The relative depth is increasing while the BH horizon is getting thinner and approaches the surface. And people ask, how can this be? Why isn't the BH, since the BH horizon or podzolization in Florida is claimed to be related to the condition of poor drainage and fluctuating water tables, why doesn't the BH just follow the water table downward? So I'll get back to that question in a minute. What we can infer is that the BH is not, in these settings, a bathtub ring. We can see that they actually diverge as we move toward better drainage. This is just a couple of cores at two ends of a transition like that, showing that even in the drier end, sometimes some remnant of the BH is still there. If you don't go far enough into the excessively drained area, you can have thin BH horizons that are underlying the A horizon and sometimes confused with the A horizon. But they're distinct and they have a higher aluminum and iron content. In fact, the elevated or the shallower, thinner BH horizon generally has more iron than the deeper BH horizon, which most of the time in well-expressed spodosols in Florida, iron is pretty low to almost non-existent, and it's dominated by aluminum. This is a picture of a trench along one of those transitions. In the far background is a wetland. In the intermediate area, since I don't have a pointer, you can talk anywhere in here because we don't need a microphone. So we have a little zone of flatwoods vegetation, and to the rear of the photographer here, who happened to be a student, Jeff Lakuta, is a marginal sandhills. So we don't quite make it out of the podzolization, but it almost does when you get all the way back. This is an extremely common trend at these transitions. I've seen them over and over and over again. This is just a depiction of a sandhill area near, I guess, a toe slope or foot slope that I've cordoned off here, about 10 meters, and we have those three soils. And we look at the mineralogy. I guess I'm finally throwing in some mineralogy here. We can see that the sediment was uniform with depth. But just 10 meters over where we have the spodosol, we're pretty much lacking all spilosilicates. And so we have a total dominance, of course, until we get to the BH, in which case the mineralogy continues with what it was before. So you can see that there is a coating redistribution, and the components of those coatings are having a big effect on the mineralogy, on the alluviation of the coatings is being expressed or being evidenced through the mineralogy. And these are, let me go back. So we have the coated zone and then the uncoated zone. And this is sort of just a drawing of depicted of one of these transitions where over here you have green coatings, and as you start to move toward the better expressed spodosol, you see the coatings are migrating down and they're starting to accumulate. So let me see what I have next here. And so you have the three soils that I've depicted here. These are some ideas that I'm going to propose now. I sometimes joke that science is about doubt, retaining doubt, and I've always been wary of people who have all the answers, but now I have all the answers. So you want to be wary of what I say. But these are just some ideas I'm proposing to explain what happens at the transition. That the process requires a threshold duration of near surface saturation. Organic acid activity biogeochemically is enhanced. That would be because you're reducing the mineralization rates of these acids and they're being released in the near surface. Iron, incidentally, is depleted by redox. Organic acids chip away at the aluminum at each threshold event. Grain coatings release when aluminum oxide binding agents destabilize. Remember I said that it's metal oxides that are holding the grain coatings on. If we destabilize the metal oxides, everything on the coating moves. Not just the organics, not just the aluminum, but the hydroxyinterlayers, vermiculite, the kaolinite, everything on the coating is, and actually, technically in most cases, there's enough of an increase in clay content between the E and the BH that it would be an argillic horizon. It would satisfy the requirements for an argillic horizon in terms of clay increase, say 3%. But of course, the BH or spodic horizon takes precedent over that. So it's not just organoaluminum, but it's all the other components on the coatings that all would have been on the coatings. The E and BH expression increases with increasing frequency of that threshold, and it's a self-defeating process because when you accumulate enough stuff down there, you're going to bind things up enough and it's going to start to stabilize. And at that point, you have formed a well-expressed BH horizon. So looking at it here, we have a depiction of a schematic of the water table and a cross-section of the transition. And at the top, I have an E horizon thickness on the y-axis, and I have frequency of threshold, frequency that you reach the threshold duration of saturation necessary to bring about those biogeochemical processes that destabilize the metal oxide coatings. So as we move across, we see that as we move toward wetter conditions, that frequency is going to increase. So if you switch from the delta x's to the d x's, then you would see that the curve defined by that frequency of threshold is very similar to the shape of the E horizon itself. Another face that I wanted to introduce is one that's common to old dunes. It's not necessarily exclusive to old dunes, but by my experience, I pretty much have associated it with old dunes. And these are beautiful soils. The E horizon is well expressed, but the BH horizon is discontinuous and is less expressed than other soils and flatwoods. These soils can be well drained or somewhat moderately well drained, and they're classified as spodic quartz descendants. But this is certainly a podzolization process. Why it happens here, I don't know. Why it's associated with old dunes, I don't know. But podzolization is not exclusively restricted to poorly drained conditions in Florida. There are drowned BH horizons on both coasts of Florida. This is Rex Ellis, one of the authors of that. And this is a friend of ours, Travis Richardson, doing a fiber core extraction. And this is the core that he extracted. They extracted from just off of an island near Cedar Key on the Gulf Coast. A really thick podzolized carbon is being drowned by sea level rise. And there's a talk today on that on this particular topic by Todd Osborne. These are just pictures of where it's been exposed here during low tide. And I've seen exposures of these BH horizons, ledges of them, along in the Panama City beach area and along the Gulf Coast. So we have giant faces, and Yaslin Gonzalez talked in fair detail about that this morning, so I'm not going to repeat too much, but I'm just going to review a little bit about what these things are about. this is a soil BH, a normal soil BH, and this is what we've referred to as deep pozzolized carbon, which was a topic of Yaslin's talk. And you can see that it can be greater than or less than 2 meters, and it can be a BH or a BH prime under different scenarios. And it's a huge organic carbon pool that's unaccounted for in the southeastern United States. We've estimated in a previous publication that of 431 teragrams in Florida BH horizons within the upper 2 meters. But down here, we could be up in the petagram scale, a billion tons of carbon that's unaccounted for. And obviously the potential for carbon gain or loss is tied to climate and sea level. In fact, I think that there could be sea level positions that could be teased out of these coalescing BH horizons. And this is a slide that Yes presented too, of relic shorelines with deep sands from deep sands of relic shorelines that are distributed all the way up the Gulf and Atlantic coast. And it's in these deep sands that this deep pozzolized carbon can be found. This is another one of the images that Yaslin presented today. I'm going to elaborate a little bit. If we start over here, we look at a normal Sotosol profile, aquatic profile, and where we have the BH here, and then you go through that deeper down, we have another BH, a BH prime. In this case, you notice that there's a morphological differences here between the two. One is that we have a really well-stripped E horizon above the upper one, and the BH is pretty puny. But below the BH, we still have coated grain. And then below that, so we don't have a really thoroughly stripped deep horizon, even the horizon above the deeper one. And we notice also, despite the abrupt or clear boundary of the upper BH, the lower BH is a very gradual boundary. And that's very common as well. And I think that is attributable to them forming by a different hydrologic process. That in the upper case, we have a definite redistribution. In the lower case, it looks like carbon is somehow just getting here at different levels of vortex. With this being less frequent and this being more frequently saturated, that we're having carbon getting introduced into that zone that is being stabilized in its association with metals there, not necessarily redistributing the metals there. And I said, all the deep pozzolic carbon greater than 2 meters is unaccounted for. There's another giant. I call it the thick white pozzolized sand. So when we look at BH depth in soil taxonomy, we see we can have eric or typic spodosols with a BH less than 75 centimeters deep. Arenic spodosols, BH 75 to 125. Gross arenic spodosols, BH greater than 125 centimeters deep. And then what happens after that? See, there's stuff down below that we don't have an answer for. So those soils are classified as intersols. Intersols are other soils. They're not necessarily young soils, although probably all young unweathered soils are intersols. But just because all unweathered soils may be intersols, that doesn't mean that all intersols are unweathered. And in Florida, the majority of intersols are probably profoundly weathered and have been the result of intense pedogenesis. And this is just one example of that. I don't have any problem with that so much, as long as we recognize that. As long as we don't define intersols all the time as young unweathered soils, when the predominance in many cases that is not always the case, particularly in this area. This is a map that, thanks to Alan Bacon for this. These are the white sand areas. The white sands I'm talking about, the series, and they're differentiated only by drainage. St. Lucie, Satellite, and Archbold. And this is just a picture of one. You don't get sand that white easily. And these sands are intensely podzolized. And with the grains, it's totally stripped. Now I added another soil. This is the Gross Arena orthide duet, alorthide. So I added that in it, and it's purple. You can see that it's intermingled with these other St. Lucie, Archbold, and Satellite. So it's a spodosol intermingled with those. And so basically we have a white sand intisol, white sand spodosol, sand, and that's a sandy solution, hyperthermic, enthic gross arenic alorthide. Very thick white E with the BH with the upper boundary less than 125 centimeters. So the duet will carry it down to a meter, 2 meters, and it will still be duet. If it's 200.05 centimeters, it's no longer duet anymore. It's no longer a spodosol anymore. It's an intisol. That's okay with me too, as long as we recognize that. So I'm going to zoom in a little bit on this area so you can see a little better. This is the duet mixed in here. And this is a duet mixed in here. And you can see, there's a ridge here. At the political boundary between two counties, we switch from duet to St. Lucie. So we see that they occur together. We see that basically we have the same process, but we're arbitrarily we have an arbitrary 2 meter limit. People sometimes think that I'm advocating we routinely dig deeper than two meters, and I'm not advocating that at all. I'm only advocating to keep your eyes open, to look at the opportunities to see deep excavations, to pay attention to what you just augured over a few meters away, and to pay attention to the very white sands that you can infer are the consequence of podzolization. So the logic and horizon designation. So I've got duet in St. Lucie here. We have 3 layers, basically. A five-year-old. How many layers do you have there? And a five-year-old will say, 1, 2, 3. And so then we dig a hole to 2 meters. We auger a hole. In St. Lucie, that's what we have. In duet, we actually encounter the BH horizon within 2 meters. So then we can draw a line between the two soils from a standpoint of mapping. And so we have a duet, a spodosol and an intisol separated out, which is okay with me too. Then we describe the intisol. And then we describe the spodosol, then we describe the intisol. And I don't know about you folks, but that makes no sense. We as pedologists of all people should interpret the landscape holistically. And I think that this representation tends to derail a clear and holistic understanding of soil formation on older landscapes in Florida. So I just commented here that horizon designation should precede and remain independent of soil classification. You don't anticipate what the classification is going to be, and you say, I don't want an intisol to have an E horizon. Well, an intisol can have an E horizon. An intisol is 2 words, other soils. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to get into this rant. So the main points that I have, podzolization is intimately linked with hydrology in the southeastern United States. Convoluted EBH boundaries reflect water flow rather than infilling. Hydrologic linkages differ for shallow BH versus deep podzolic carbon. Deep podzolic carbon represents a massive pool of unaccounted for carbon. Sea level rise is drowning formerly terrestrial podzolic carbon. Some of you folks have actually seen this on a geomorphology tour. Horizon designations should be based on scientific rather than bureaucratic criteria. and many intersols of Florida are old and intensely weathered. And so that's my spiel. You can read all these really fast, but at least I have them here as a record for all the people that, you know, all the citations that all the things that I've cited in the slides. And I'll stop and take questions.
We can do a couple of questions for what?
Yes.
Has anyone done any mapping on the depth of the DH horizon to see if the St. Lucie shows up as holes where the Duet might be mapped to that DH horizon, the depth?
Yeah, you know, I don't think, I think the closest I can come is what Alan helped me with, that, with the white sands that he projected out there. There are other gross arenic allophides, and I just picked Duet, so there are others, and I think you could bring all those together and see if you could establish more associations between the two. This is also the case for gross arenic paleozoals and the quartzy sediments as well. That soils that are described as AC soils can occur in a complex or in adjacent map units with soils that are described as AEBT horizons that are ultisols. So soils that are depicted as intensely weathered and soils that are depicted as minimally weathered, intimately associated, because at the 2-meter boundary, the decision was made to call those C's instead of E's. So I realize that this probably could stand more documentation than I've given, but I'm pretty confident in what I'm saying at this point. Any other questions?
I'm curious, when you say old soils, what kind of age do you mean old?
Well, some of these soils probably on surfaces that are very early Pleistocene or maybe late Pliocene. And the Central Ridge of Florida is a pretty old surface. And there are other older surfaces too in the northeastern part of Florida, right? Trail Ridge is being one of them you may have heard of.
Great. I'm fascinated by these deep ontolic carbon accumulations. Those are fantastic. That is a pile of carbon.
Right. Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks to all the speakers. Well, thanks for coming.
Question, Willie.
Yes.
Some of those deep mudzolics, yes, that they find on the islands in the Gulf Coast there, this sort of thing, what sort of, did they form in the same kind of environment that we're seeing with mudzolics, terrestrial mudzolics now?
Whenever I see, the one we saw, you were there, actually, Bill, at Cedar Key or near Cedar Key, Seahorse Key, was really thick.
Oh,
and so
it was 6 feet thick.
It was way thick, yeah. So, and we didn't reach the bottom of it, I don't think. So that suggests to me that it was originally the deep podzolic type, you know, rather than the one that's fairly thin and that occurs at transitions between drainage that are affected by near surface drainage. The deeper ones are not affected by near surface drainage, but they transgress the whole landscape from excessively drained to poorly drained. So the fact that it's so thick, that it was so thick, would make me suspect that those that are thick like that were formed in the way that we see the deep podzolic carbon layers today.
All right, great. Okay. Thanks, everybody. Thank you.